Good afternoon. You are tuned to the Juno Afternoon here for Friday, the October 21st version of 2016. I'm Jeff Reynolds, I'll be your host for today. We'll be learning about the Juno Skating Club with Board President Melissa Fritch and Tammy Bowman. Zach Stenson will be here with the details about this weekend's 5th annual Zombie Walton. Barry McNeil, the distributor of the Alaska Positive Show, will be here to talk about his work. Elaine Shorter will be here to highlight the Climate Film Festival. Christine Nimi Erickson will be here at the preview of tonight's Poetry Slam. And I'll talk with Jazz Host about Saturday's Red Ribbon event at the Nugget Mall. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music and more today on a Juno afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, showers likely mainly after 7 p.m. Saturday, showers, high temperatures near 46 degrees. For Saturday night, showers likely, most likely between 7 o'clock and later.
Reporting from the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Fairbanks, I'm Zachariah Hughes. On the first official day of AFN, the Carlson Center was lit up by the keynote address. It started off with remarks from Athabascan elder Emil Noti, who observed how far the convention has come in its 50 years.
The story of land claims is a story of sacrifice on the part of so many people who participated in early days.
Noti's speech was a methodical history of the whos and the hows behind the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. That was hardly the style of the second speaker, brought on stage by AFN co-chair Anna Hoffman.
The next person that is going to address you is identified in our agenda as an emerging Native leader. I would argue that she has fully emerged.
33-year-old Megan Alvana Stimpfel grew up in Nome. After college and graduate school in Washington, D.C., she spent several years working as a legislative aide to Senator Lisa Murkowski. Alvana Stimpfel's 40-minute speech ricocheted between policy, politics, and the personal.
I'm a King Islander. The strength of my identity has survived colonization by the U.S. government. It has survived the forced relocation from our island.
Alvana Stimpfel's address acknowledged the legacy of gains made by organizations like AFN, while also making controversial calls for policies that would collapse divisions between corporate and community institutions. Those included a request for ANCSA corporations to reconsider not allotting shares to so-called afterborns, as well as ceding state and corporate powers to local governments.
We must be able to question leadership without fear of losing our campsites, of those managing our lands. We need to pay attention to how corporations organize their voting, because those in power will change the rules to stay in power.
A consistent theme throughout the speech was the need for Alaska Natives to become more directly involved in the state's social and political institutions, schools, village corporations, and especially state government. Alvana Stimpfel drew wide applause with calls to indigenize institutions that have historically pushed a colonial agenda. One of the last recommendations offered was for a candidate training center at AFN each year to prepare Alaska Natives to run for state office.
Because it's up to all of you to change our state.
Summing up just after the keynotes, Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott said the speakers represented two of the year's main themes of reflect, refresh, and renew. Noti reflected, and Alvana Stimpfel refreshed. Later in the day, artist Susie Siluk read a letter to the full conference on the negative effects Alaska Native carvers are beginning to see from state-level bans on ivory. It was the topic of an official field hearing held by Senator Dan Sullivan, who convened a panel of experts, including Dr. Rosita Worrell, for testimony on the legality and effects of such bans.
Suppression of the ivory market will be devastating to Alaska Native hunters, craftspeople, and artisans.
Regional leaders from the North Slope and Bering Strait regions say that the bans in California and New Jersey are leading to confusion and prompting a drop in sales, as well as unlawful confiscations of walrus ivory products. That, in turn, is expected to begin hurting rural Alaska's already weak cash economies. Sullivan took recommendations from those who spoke that he says he'll bring up with federal partners and conservation groups. Conference's main program wrapped up with a discussion of lands into trust by a panel of experts, and an open conversation about how tribes in Alaska should proceed with potential claims. Larry Roberts, an assistant secretary for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, says it's an exciting time for tribes in Alaska to have a landed trust option and be able to observe models that have worked in the lower 48.
And so I would say the vast majority of the applications that we have approved during this administration have been more in those rural areas.
In a panel filled with representatives from the federal and state governments, along with attorneys and activists, many noted that the most significant part of the discussion was that it was happening at all, and so diplomatically. Reporting from AFN, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The AFN Newscast is a production of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation and Native Voice One. Funding provided by the Siri Foundation, Calista Corporation, the Atwood Foundation, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, ConocoPhillips, Manilik Association, Rasmussen Foundation, and South Central Foundation. This is a production of KNBA, Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, and Native Voice One.
It's 6 minutes past the hour in your tune two, Juneau afternoon. First guests are here to talk about ice skating. President of the Juneau Skating Club, Melissa Fritch, and Tammy Bowman, former board member here in the studio. Thank you for coming by today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So would you like to tell me a little bit about the Juneau Skating Club, how many members it has, and how old they are?
Sure. We have figure skaters. We have 33 figure skaters currently. We have 22 students and then 11 adults. We have a lot of other members that take skating lessons with us, and we are growing, and we're pretty excited about that.
Is it for figure skaters or hockey skaters?
You know, the Juneau Skating Club, we have, like I said, quite a few figure skaters, but we have a great Learn to Skate program, which teaches people of all levels and all disciplines. We have a brand new program this year we're really excited about, which is Learn to Skate USA. It's brand new. It's been endorsed by U.S. Figure Skating, USA Hockey, and by U.S. Speed Skating. So it's a brand new program, teaches skills across the board to all skaters.
And does it differ from other methods of teaching?
In the past, I think a lot of people thought of the Juneau Skating Club as just for figure skaters. And so we're just really wanting to emphasize that we work with figure skaters as well as teach skills that will really benefit hockey players and even people that want to try speed skating.
Speed skating, and you also do synchronized skating.
We do synchronized skating. Tammy, do you want to tell a little bit about our upcoming exciting trip that our youth synchronized skating team has coming up?
Sure, thanks. We have, I believe, 12 girls going to Fond du Lac, Wisconsin in January. And these girls skate together. It's actually really, really fast. A lot of people ask, is it like synchronized swimming? But it's much faster than synchronized swimming is. They move really fast together in a synchronized way. It's pretty exciting to watch and exciting to do.
When is the next set of lessons coming up?
We're actually on our one-week break right now, and we start lessons for session two next week. We have three different times that are available. We have homeschool lessons that we teach in the mornings on Tuesdays. Those are from 9:45 to 10:45. And then on Fridays, for adults and kids ages 6 and up, that's 6:30 to 7:30. And Saturdays, we teach 4- and 5-year-olds and then all skaters ages 6 and up. But we don't have specific adult classes on Saturday, but they're welcome to join the kids. And that is from 11:45 to 12:45.
What do people who are interested in skating need to bring?
You need to bring layers to the rink because obviously it is an ice rink. It's pretty cold. But once you get moving on the ice, you may want to take off a layer, a jacket, a sweatshirt. So we always recommend for the young kids, especially we want them to wear helmets. There are those available for borrowing at the rink at no cost. We do include skate rental in our lesson cost. Lessons are $90 for 6 weeks. People register online at JunoSkatingClub.org and they pay for their lessons by Monday, they'll receive a $10 discount and it will be $80 for those 6 weeks.
What's the hardest thing for people to learn about when they're learning how to skate for the first time?
You know, it's Tammy,
to learn how to fall down and stand up.
I think that's the first thing that we teach. And for the littlest kids, we actually teach that off the ice. Before they even get on the ice, we teach them how to fall down safely and then how to get back up. So we'll start really, really basic. We'll start with falling down, getting back up, marching in place, marching across the ice, gliding, and it goes from there. And so the great thing about Learn to Skate USA is it builds on those skills. And so we'll start with the real basic skills, like I said, and they'll move up through the levels. They'll work with a coach, and they'll have some practice time during those lessons. They do a half-hour lesson and a half-hour in the practice area, and they'll have that opportunity to improve their skills and move up level to level.
And you have some recitals that are regularly scheduled.
We do. We have our holiday show is our gift to Juno. It is free, and it is Sunday, the December 11th. It's from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. Tammy, do you want to tell a little bit about the recital?
The recital actually is really fun. The skaters look forward to it every year. They get to pick their own music and choreograph their own program to share with the community of Juno.
And how much are they again for the lessons?
The lessons are $90 for 6 weeks, and if you register online at junoskatingclub.org and you pay by Monday, then it's a $10 discount. It would be $80 for the 6 weeks of lessons.
We're talking about the Juno Skating Club with Tammy Bowman and Melissa Fritsch. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, I think we covered everything.
I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah, we're really excited for people to come out to the rink, and we look forward to seeing everybody on the ice.
Website one more time, please.
JunoSkatingClub.org.
And an email?
JunoSkate with the number 8 at hotmail.com.
All right, thanks for coming by.
All right, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, October 21st, 2016. It was on this date in 1512 Martin Luther joined the faculty of the University of Wittenberg. He'd spent time in the monastery. He was disillusioned with that. He took a job as professor of theology. And in the process of preparing lessons for his students, he was led to think more deeply about his own faith and what it was that bothered him about the Catholic Church. 5 years later, Pope Leo X announced the sale of indulgences to help finance the construction of St. Peter's in Rome. You could give money to the church to lessen your punishment for your sins, which enraged Luther. He wrote his document, Disputation on the Power of Indulgences, which we know as the 95 Theses, nailed them to the door of the university chapel in Wittenberg, and that began the Protestant Reformation. It's the birthday of the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, born Devonshire, England, 1772. He became a close friend of the poet William Wordsworth, and the first year of their friendship, taking long walks in the country, was the most productive period of Coleridge's life. Both of them liked to compose while walking. They took long walks. Wordsworth liked to stay on the path. Coleridge liked to walk through the woods, but he came up with his great masterpiece, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Story of a sailor brings a curse on his ship when he kills the bird, and for the rest of his voyage he's tormented by sea monsters and the ghosts of his dead shipmates. But within a few years of writing that, his life began to fall apart. He became addicted to opium. That ended the friendship with Wordsworth. He had a long list of projects in mind, including a two-volume history of English prose, a translation of Faust, a musical about Adam and Eve, a history of logic, a history of German metaphysics, a study of witchcraft, an encyclopedia, and he failed to complete any of them. It's the birthday of Ursula Le Guin, born Berkeley, California, 1929, best known for her Earthsea series of books about a world populated by wizards and dragons. Ursula Le Guin, who said, "It is above all by the imagination that we achieve perception and compassion and hope." Her advice to writers: if lack of motivation is a constant problem, perhaps writing is not your forte. I mean, what is the problem? If writing bores you, that is pretty fatal. But if you find that it's hard going and it just doesn't flow, well, what did you expect? It is work. Art is work. It's the birthday of Carrie Fisher, Beverly Hills, 1956, author of the novel Postcards from the Edge, and her memoirs Wishful Drinking and Shockaholic. And it's the birthday of the jazz trumpeter, composer, Dizzy Gillespie, Cheraw, South Carolina, 1917, one of the inventors of bebop, who said, "I don't care too much about music. What I like is sounds." Here's a poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge on his birthday. What if you slept, and what if in your sleep you dreamed? And what if in your dream you went to heaven and there plucked a strange and beautiful flower? And what if when you awoke you had that flower in your hand? Ah, what then? What If You Slept by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services in the Jordan Creek Center. Northern Audiology offers diagnostic medical hearing expertise and digital technology hearing instruments. 789-6780.
It's 16 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into Juno Afternoon. In the studio, we have Zach Stinson, an instructor, and we have several zombies who have just wandered into the room. Welcome to the show, gang. You're here to talk about the zombie run. You want to, Zach Stinson, you want to introduce to some of these people here?
Sure, yeah. Actually, I'm going to let them introduce themselves. Zombies, can you introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Caitlin.
I'm Cedar.
I'm Carmen.
I'm Spencer.
You want to tell me about the zombie run, please?
This is the fifth annual zombie run, and it's where people run a 5K run or a 1 mile run, and they get chased by zombies, and they have three flags, and the zombies try to get the flags. It's on Sunday, October 23rd, 2016.
And where should
people
meet?
And it's at Sandy Beach.
Have you been practicing your zombie talking and stuff like that?
Maybe.
Did people have to bring their brains?
Yes, we love them.
Yes, they're delicious.
So it's one.
We have two events. There's a 1 mile run for the little kids, and then for the bigger kids and adults, it's a 5K.
It's a fundraiser.
It's a fundraiser for ahead, Spencer Kaelin.
The triathlon clips from Harborview and Haiti,
because in Haiti there was Hurricane Matthew, so we're also fundraising for the people there.
So how does the fundraising work?
So the entry fee for the event goes to pay for our kids' triathlon club at Harborview. And then in addition, there'll be a jar that will be there for anybody that wants to contribute to fundraising for efforts to help the people in Haiti. Our school nurse, Kesley, was in Haiti this last June and was working in a clinic there. And so she wants to send some funds over to help that clinic with the people dealing with the hurricane.
Are people encouraged to bring costumes?
Yes, definitely. Just not zombie costumes, because the triathlon zombies are going to be already dressed up as zombies.
But they can dress up scary. If a few zombies show up, it's fine.
And they should meet at Sandy Beach what time?
Registration starts at 12, and the kids 5K is going to start at 12:30. The 1 mile, starts at 12:30, and the 5K starts at 1:15.
And how much is it again?
$10, $15 for adults.
$15 for kids and $25 for adults.
At the end of the run, at the end of the race, whoever has some of their brains left, and the way the race works is if they have everybody gets a flag, like Carmen was saying, and if anybody has any flags left, the zombies are going to try to take your flags over the course of the run. And if anybody has flags left, yeah, go ahead, Spencer.
They get a bandana that says, "I survived."
But if you don't have any flags left, if the zombies get every one of those flags on the run, Caitlin?
You get a bandana that says, I'm zombified.
Is it a lot of fun?
Yes.
Have you done it before?
Yes.
Yes. This is the fifth annual. How many have you tried before?
How many years? How many years have you guys done the zombie run?
5 years.
Five years.
I have done it for 2 years.
2 years for Carmen. Spencer, how many have you done it?
2 years.
2 years.
And if people need more information, how can they get it?
So they can contact, let's see, if you have questions, you can contact Vanessa at 723-7481 or Estella at 209-9720 or Jen at 500-2676.
All right, so get us out of this interview. Can we just have some zombie sounds, please? All right, thank you for coming by.
Hope you guys can join us. It's going to be a fun event. Thank you.
Look out for zombies.
Well, now, back to back, belly to belly, well, I don't give a damn for the dumb that I'm making. Back to back, belly to belly, every zombie jamboree, Nahiti caught us. Back to back, belly to belly, well, I don't give a damn for the dumb that I'm making. Back to back, belly to belly, every zombie jamboree. Zombie jamboree took place in a New York cemetery.
Where?
Zombie jamboree took place in Long Island Cemetery. Zombies from all parts of the island.
Where?
Some of them are great Calypsonians.
Zombies.
Hey, since the season was carnival, they got together in Bacchanal. What you doing?
Back to back, belly to belly, well, I don't give a damn, it's a dozen that are ready. Back to back, belly to belly, it's a zombie jamboree. Back to back, belly to belly, well, I don't give a damn, cause I don't know it is. Back to back, belly to belly, at the zombie jamboree.
One female zombie wouldn't behave. She says she wants me more slave. In the one hand, she's holding a quart of wine.
Oh.
In the other, she's pointing that she'll be mine. Well, believe me, folks, yes, I had to run.
Why?
The husband of a zombie ain't no fun.
Don't
I says, oh no, my turtle's out. That old bag of bones I cannot love. But what you doing?
Back to back.
Right then and there she raised a feast. I'm a-going to catch you now, my sweet. I'm gonna make you call me Sweetie Pie. I says, oh no, get back, you lie. I may be lying, but you will see.
What?
After you kiss this dead zombie.
Yeah!
Well, I've never seen such a horror in my life. Can you imagine me with a zombie wife?
Yes!
Back to back. Belly to belly, well, I don't give a damn, cause I done that already. Back to back. Belly to belly, every zombie jamboree. You're all alone, you know. Back to back. Belly to belly, well, I don't give a damn, cause I done that already. Back to back. Belly to belly, every zombie jamboree.
23 minutes past the hour, that was the Kingston Trio. Next in the studio, we have Jackie Manning and Larry McNeil. Larry's the juror for the Alaska Positive Show, and it's happening, opening tonight with a lecture at 7 o'clock at the APK building. Thanks for coming down, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Larry, you're quite a photographer. How long have you been taking pictures?
Since 1975.
Do you remember your first camera?
I do. It was a Kodak Brownie that my grandmother gave me here in Juneau.
I think Brownies are pretty common as far as people's first cameras.
It's a cool little camera. I wish I still had it. I'd pay $100 for that camera.
In what ways did it open artistic doors for you?
I'm sorry?
In what ways did it open artistic doors?
It allowed me to capture everyday life around Juneau and took snapshots of siblings and mostly neighborhood dogs.
How's your work changed over the years?
It's changed to tell stories of my experiences I'm having now and so forth and what's going on in the world. And right now I'm doing a series on global climate change. You know, that seems to be a hot topic of our time. So I'm just trying to figure it out like everybody else.
How's your heritage affected your work?
How is my
heritage?
It you know, the photography has to do with telling stories. And with my own heritage, I'm able to know certain parts of you know, my own Tlingit background and to be able to tell stories that has a kind of authenticity to it. And I think what's cool is that since I'm also an American boy, just like so many others, I can tell that part of the story too. So it's an interesting kind of intersection.
You're a judge and also a photographer. What's the difference between this? What's your job as a judge?
It's trying to be fair and to see the kind of talents that all the different people have and to appreciate their vision, because there's such a wide spectrum of just really nice work being made.
What's it like being a judge and a photographer at the same time?
I like being a judge. You know, since I teach photography, I'm used to seeing a lot of different kinds of work. And my job as a professor of photography is to help nurture young photographers with their own work. And that's what I try to do when I'm judging, too, you know, is to find the excellence within the work and to bring it forth, hopefully.
What's the first thing you tell students when they're taking a photography class from you?
To know their own backgrounds and to be able to tell the story of who they are and know their, that's pretty much it right there. Know their backgrounds to be able to make a visual manifestation of that. And that's the challenge right there, to be able to do that.
Yeah. What's your favorite kind of picture?
You know, I don't think I have a favorite kind. I love all kinds of different landscapes. You know, I love looking at photographs of people also, people photographs and animals, studio photographs. Since I have a formal background in photography, I love just about anything made in a studio because it shows that people appreciate the craft of photography. And I think that with all those different genres, you know, there's the ability to capture some kind of art form. So that's what I find to be very appealing about it. Yeah.
Jackie, the lecture is tonight at 7 o'clock?
Yes. Larry's lecture is tonight at 7 at the APK building in our lecture hall. And the exhibit will open on November 4th. And the Larry's lecture, he has one at 7 tonight, and that's sponsored by the Friends. And then tomorrow he flies up to Anchorage, and he's having a lecture there at the Anchorage Museum at 7 as well, and that's sponsored by the Alaska Photographic Center. And just to give you a little background on Alaska Positive, Alaska Positive started in 1970, and so this is the 46th year. And I looked it up, and Larry McNeil is our 30th juror for Alaska Positive, and it's pretty neat to have him, you know, having been raised in Juneau, and we've had photographers from all over the U.S. and to come back and have Larry come up here and do the Alaska Positive. This year has been great. He did make the final selection today, and I can announce our award winners.
That'd be great.
I'd like to go ahead and let you know that Juror's Choice went to Chris Miller for Mindenhall Mulan. There's two awards of recognition. One went to Cody Swanson for Mid-Sagittal Lovers, and the other one went to Deborah Tharp for The Timekeeper's Ledger. And then there are four honorable mentions. One went to Tim Remick with for A Quest for the Lost. O'Hara Shipe got an honorable mention for Holy Roller. Dennis Walworth got an honorable mention for The Knot. And Dean Coley got an honorable mention for Ariel Turnigan Arm Mudflat Fan.
How many entries were submitted?
Over 300.
Wow.
And Larry narrowed that down to... It was a two-part juring process. The first part was online. He looked at them digitally and then narrowed that down to about 55. Those photographers sent their work in, and he's now narrowed it down to 36. So it looks like a beautiful show. So I'm looking forward to the opening on November 4th. And, of course, hearing more from Larry tonight at 7 o'clock at the State Museum. I do have one other announcement. The Friends of SLAM, State Library Archives and Museum, is hosting a series of lectures and a workshop to go with Alaska Positive this year. And so on Friday, November 18th, we will have Brian and Ash Adams Two guest photographers from Anchorage are going to come down and give a lecture. And then on Saturday, November 19th, they're going to give a workshop for middle school and high school students. And then on December 15th, Chris Miller is going to give a lecture at APK. And then on Friday, January 20th, Ben Huff is going to give a lecture at APK. And that's all sponsored by the Friends. So looking forward to it.
I'm talking with Larry McNeil and Jackie Manning of the Alaska Positive Show. Larry, I just had a question on the tip of my tongue. What's your lecture you're going to be talking about tonight?
Tonight I'll be just briefly talking about the work itself, and then I'll go in and talk about my own work and kind of experiences I've had, including growing up here in Alaska, you know, and the kind of work that I had to do in order to succeed as a photographer. And that included doing things like being a commercial fisherman and a pipeliner, you know, to help pay my education and so forth. So I feel like I'm an Alaska boy coming home and seeing the homies again, you know, so that's great.
All right, thanks for coming by. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, just thanks again to Larry. It's been an honor to have him here. So, thank you.
Thank you. It's been my honor.
Looking back 50 years of AFN, the Alaska Federation of Natives got its start in 1966. It focused mainly on land claims for many years. In the 1980s, AFN turned more of its attention to social, tribal, and economic issues. Today, it continues to promote laws, policies, and programs in areas such as health, education, resource development, labor, and government. Natives have for-profit regional, village, and urban corporations. Regional nonprofits and tribes provide services to Natives. During the annual AFN convention, corporate, nonprofit, and tribal representatives meet. The number of delegates is based on the population of the areas represented. At the annual AFN convention, delegates hear speeches on issues and adopt resolutions on challenges Alaska Natives face. AFN sends the approved resolutions to agencies and politicians. AFN uses them as guides for their own work. Tara Sweeney is an Arctic Slope Regional Corporation vice president.
Unity should be defined by what we have in common, what we are all striving for as Native people, and that's self-determination.
Jory Zillis is vice president of First Alaskans Institute.
I would like to see our Alaska Native people standing proud for their culture, all of us feeling love of who we are, standing together and not apart.
The AFN convention is also a fun, exciting time. During the AFN convention, people shop for school clothes and supplies. They buy gifts at the AFN Arts and Crafts Fair. And the AFN convention is the state's largest gathering. That makes it a good place to visit with relatives and old friends and to make new friends, too. Looking Back, 50 Years of AFN is a production of Kwanic Broadcast Corporation.
It's 32 minutes past the hour, and our next guest in the studio is Elaine Schroeder, here to talk about a climate action film series. Elaine, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you wanted to describe the films and how you came to select these?
Well, I'm a film buff now after the first series. And so what I did is I viewed probably two dozen movies, and I chose the three very best. And here's what's interesting, Jeff. The more extreme weather events we are having, it seems to nudge documentary filmmakers to make more climate change films. So the more that climate change heats up, the more films I have to view and pick from. So I've picked three what I consider dynamite movies, and they're balanced. So it's not like there are three movies about the same thing. There's all different angles, and so it's really worthwhile to see all three movies if you possibly can.
For you, what makes them so important?
What makes them important is climate change is so important. It's probably, it is the most daunting catastrophe, the most daunting event that we have ever had in human history. It's unprecedented, and it threatens everything from our food supply, oceans rising, and even in sweet little old Southeast Alaska, our fish runs and our trees that are now suffering from spruce aphid infestation. infestation.
Talking with Lillian Schroeder about the Climate Action Film Series, and since it's a series, I imagine there's more than one film.
There are three, and what I'd like to talk today about is the first movie, which will be occurring Sunday, this coming Sunday, October 23rd at 4:30 p.m., and Monday, October 24th at 7 p.m., and both of those will be at Gold Town Theater, as will all the films. And it is titled, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things the Climate Can't Change. And it's by Josh Fox, who's an Oscar-nominated documentary film director. And he did Gaslands, which is a lot of people have seen Gaslands, an extraordinary film about gas fracking. And now what Josh has done is travel to 12 countries, 6 continents, to places that are deeply affected by climate change. For example, Brooklyn, post-Sandy, Beijing, pollution wreck, Beijing, oil in the Amazon River, meeting with innovators and activists who are doing something about fossil fuel infrastructure and really working to keep as much carbon in the ground as possible. It's really an actually thrilling movie. Josh has been touring with the movie to 100 towns and cities that are key sites of fossil fuel infrastructure. And so what the climate change movement has recognized is that the change has to be grassroots, because in a corporate America, corporate-controlled politicians, we're not going to be able to just vote climate change out of office. We're going to have to do a lot more than that. We're going to have to really push even good politicians. We're going to have to push them from behind to enact the kind of laws and policies that drastically and quickly reduce our climate, our carbon footprint.
Did you have a chance to talk to any of these filmmakers?
Well, if we had been among the 100 cities, Josh Fox went with the film everywhere, and he would have post-film discussions about action plans in that particular town. And he was often accompanied by popular musicians and movie stars like Susan Sarandon. Leonardo DiCaprio has just come out with a new film, which I hope we'll have soon. But a lot of movie stars are getting on the bandwagon, as are innumerable numbers of normal citizens.
How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things That the Climate Can't Change, Sunday and Monday at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. Want to talk about the other films in the series, please?
The other two. Okay. So Bitter 70, which sounds funny, but it's B-I-D-D-E-R, 70, is about Tinda Christopher. And it's really a moving story. It's a docudrama. It's real live documentary about a young man who was a college student in Salt Lake City, and he was part of a group, but he did this independently. So what he found out is that the BLM was auctioning off land for gas and oil development. And so what he decided to do is he got dressed up and he went into this big bidding arena. And he got the number 70. That's why it's called Bidder 70. He's the number 70 bidder. And he actually bid on some of these properties. And, of course, he couldn't pay for them, and he didn't have the money. And he ended up, after enormous publicity and trial, with 2 years in federal prison. And eventually, though, the auction under George W. Bush was found to be illegal. And Tim DeChristopher is just he's – I won't call him the Martin Luther King. That's overstating who he is, but of the climate movement. He's one of the many people that has decided to put their safety on the line, to put their lives on the line for the environment. And he's now a leading environmental activist. That's Bitter 70, which will be November 6th and November 7th at the Gold Town. Then the last one is Time to Choose, which is a brilliant movie. Variety magazine called it a dreadfully beautiful achievement. And it is really exciting and positive, because it really shows all the innovations that are happening around the world to replace carbon-produced energy. And there's hope, Because if we can get on top of it, we've got the technology. What we need is the political will. And so this movie is really taking a look at what could be possible if we only would get down into it.
It's a good way to conclude the series.
On November 20th at 4:30 and November 21st, Monday, November 21st at 7 p.m. at Gold Town Theater.
Is there a place where people can find the schedule for these movies?
Yeah, why don't you just go on the GoldTownNick.com. Why don't you go on the Goldtown Nick website, and they will have all the information and a link to be able to get to the movie. And it's Alaska Climate Action Network that is sponsoring this series and putting it on.
Lynn Shorter, thank you for coming down. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Oh, I would just like to add that the director of the film, her name is Dea Schlossberg. She was the producer of How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things That Climate Can Change. She was just filming as a journalist at the Nebraska Pipeline demonstration, and she was arrested by the Nebraska police. And with three felony charges and a maximum penalty of 45 years in prison. So this is pretty scary. And what's happening is that there's a lot of resistance to the civil disobedience that's going on, even though the producer of the movie we're going to be showing this weekend was there as a journalist filming. There's a lot of pressure to turn off her voice. But we're going to turn it on.
Elaine Shorter, thank you for coming down the station
okay.
today.
This is Bird Note. The dark-eyed junco is one of the most abundant backyard birds in North America. Every September, hordes of them move south from the boreal forest to winter across the U.S. and southern Canada. The familiar gray and white snowbird is not our only junco, though. In the southwest, a different species, the yellow-eyed junco, lives in cool mountain forests from Arizona and New Mexico through Mexico into Guatemala. The southern bird shares the neat plumage and ground-hugging habits of its dark-eyed cousin. But its eyes are an improbably bright golden yellow, like tiny brass buttons, polished to a brilliant shine and pinned to the little bird's face. The great explorer and ornithologist Francis Sumicrest was in Veracruz, Mexico in the 1860s. He reported that the locals called the junco Echa Lumbre, the caster of fire, or lightning bird. The Veracruzians, he explained, thought the birds were phosphorescent, collecting light during the day, and releasing it at night in the dim pine forests. One look at the yellow-eyed junco's weird spangled eyes, and you might almost believe it yourself. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
It's 43 minutes past the hour in your Juno afternoon. Our next guest in the studio is Janice Holst, who's been known for a long time for doing dancing stuff and red ribbon stuff. And how many things haven't you done?
Oh, well, you know, I've been teaching for 55 years, and dance, that is, and Red Ribbon Rally since 1987, and the Gold Nugget Review, and Dancers Against Drugs, so all kinds of things.
That's good. Keep you busy.
Keeps me busy, yes. Although, for the last 3 years, I closed my studio, so I've been kind of semi-retired, but two of my dancers, the Caliente sisters, opened the Fusion Dance Studio, and so now they call me in, you know, once in a while to do a ballet workshop or class for them, or just look at the shows when they're almost ready to go on, just to give my final little touch. So it's fun to do, and I appreciate it. So, yep. I feel like I'm in it. I just can't do it anymore.
And you're here to talk about the Red Ribbon Rally, which is going on tomorrow, starting at noon in the Nugget Mall.
Yes, it's going to be, not tomorrow, it's going to be the following Saturday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So the 29th at Nugget Mall from 1 to 3. And it's going to be kind of fun because we haven't done it for 3 years since I did close the studio. But since I've done it since 90, 1987, when I was Alaska's Mother of the Year, somehow that became my platform, and I've done it for 28 years or something. So it's kind of fun to do it again because, you know, drugs are still a curse on our city and every other city in the United States. And it's important to keep, you know, let the kids be involved in a positive way. The songs that we have five special songs that every one of my dancers, some of them are mothers and grandmothers now, all know the song. So I'm sure they'll be singing in the audience. And it's just real important to me to keep those kids on the right track. And the dancers are lively and fun. They're fun to watch. And this way, when other people bring their kids in the audience, it's kind of fun to see new little kids get excited about it or ask questions. And we're planning to have the police department bring their car if it's available. And the kids can have pictures with the officers and ask questions. And we've asked different people to come and talk, a little 5-minute something. So for those 2 hours, I think it's going to be very interesting, more than just watching some little kid dance. It's going to be information. And I don't know. I think the drill team is going to do a drill down. That's always fun to watch.
Who has the drill down?
The drill down, it's from JDHS, our Juno Douglas dance team. So they're going to do the drill down, so that ought to be fun. And the kids will be singing. We'll have pictures for them to color. Certain clubs are going to come and put out a table and maybe have information. And the parents can always ask questions and ask the officers anything they want to. And I think it's just going to be a nice 2 hours of being great. And we hope the mayor will be in town to come and proclaim it a great event. So
this is a week from tomorrow at 12 noon. It starts in Nugget Mall.
Well, it's really actually starts from 1 to 3, although people will be gathering and getting together and having fun. So Saturday, the 29th of October, from 1 to 3 at the Nugget Mall. And another thing, if anyone has any talent or wants to sing a song or something for 3 or 5 minutes, I'd love to get phone calls because I sort of lost touch with a lot of the phone numbers because everybody has a cell phone now and nobody has a landline, so you can't look it up in a phone book anymore. So if anyone would like to dance or their group wants to dance or sing or play the guitar, anybody, any age.
And how do they get hold of you? Do you have a telephone?
Yes, I have a cell phone too, just like everybody else. And so it would be 723-1462.
Hasn't changed over the years.
What was that?
Hasn't changed over the years.
No, it hasn't. Actually, my husband has a cell phone, and it's the old house number, 586-1462. So, yeah. So either one, 586 or 723, then it's 1462.
Janice Walsh, thanks for talking about the Red Ribbon Rally. A week from tomorrow, starts at noon, about 1 o'clock at the Nugget Mall. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Oh, I don't think so. I think everybody that comes should wear red that day if they have it, because it is a Red Ribbon Rally. So we want to do that. And I thank you for making the time for me to say this. And I hope people aren't shy about coming out. It's just a little afternoon with friends and kids, and it would be nice to see people involved in a positive way. It's all for free. So come out next week and join the Red Ribbon Rally.
Hi, this is Terry Tibbett, and I'd like to invite you to my concert and live TV recording on Friday, October 21st at KTOO. I'll play original material inspired by a life of performing, teaching, and working in Alaska. At the concert, I'll be joined by my friends and local musicians for the one-hour performance, starting at 7 p.m. on Friday, October 21st at 360 in the KTOO building. Admission is free.
Terry Tippett should be appearing at 360 downstairs at the KTVO buildings tonight at 7 o'clock. Admission is free. Should be a great concert tonight.
This is Troy Quinn, music director of the Juno Symphony. Join me and the orchestra on October 29th and 30th at JDHS as we kick off the season with an electrifying concert of new and timeless classics. We open the concert with Sibelius' majestic Andante Festivo for strings. In a career spanning more than 1,000 movie soundtracks, world-class French horn soloist Jim Thatcher joins the orchestra to play Awaysin's dramatic horn concerto. Schumann's rousing 4th symphony promises to have you on your feet with an ending not to be missed. Tickets are at Hearthside, the Jack, JunoSymphony.org, and at the door.
Woo! Wet out there. It hasn't started yet. I'm sorry. I need to take this. Sweetie, I can't talk right now. We're at a play. At the theater? I don't know, sweetie. Yes, I'll be home soon. No, nothing bad is going to happen to you, because I know. Because I'm your mother, I know everything.
Perseverance Theater presents Not Medea, a classic tale of modern motherhood, runs through November 5th. For tickets, visit ptalaska.org, The Jack, Hearthside Books, or call 463-TIXS.
The forecast for tonight, showers likely mainly after 7 p.m. Cloudy skies, the lows around 39 degrees. Forecast for Saturday, showers, high temperatures near 46 degrees. Saturday night, showers likely mostly before 7 p.m. Sunday, mostly sunny skies, high temperatures near 44 degrees.